Hello, kind listeners. You're listening to WHRW, 90.5 FM, Binghamton, New York. I'm your host, Tarik Abdulazim, and this is Civil Discourse. With the Middle East dominating foreign policy, it's easy to forget our neighbors down south. Last week, however, we talked with a director from Public Citizen about CAFTA, the Free Trade Pact for Central America. And this week, we continue our focus on the region of Latin America, specifically Colombia. In late February, Congress was set to review the human rights record of Colombia's army, a certification process required before the disbursement of more military and economic aid, a hulking anti-narcotics package that is termed Plan Colombia. However, certification process, which is usually a rubber stamp protocol, slowed to a halt when on February 21st, the army was allegedly massacred 8 residents of the peace community of San Jose de Aportado in Colombia. Today, we'll be speaking with Marcy Lay, an Ithaca resident who lived for a year at San Jose de Aportado and who just returned from a fact-finding mission. I would like to welcome to the show Marcy Lay and just thank you very much for joining us today on Civil Discourse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, how are you doing, Marcy?
I'm good.
Good, great. Good to hear you. Just a very brief introduction. I mentioned about the alleged massacre at San Jose de Aportado. First, could you just explain to us the history of this peace community?
Okay. San Jose de Aportado is one of many peace communities in Colombia, although they don't all go by the name of peace communities. Some are communities in resistance, and they have other similar names. Basically, all of these communities are independent and are based on the fact that they want to be totally unaligned in the war. They don't want to fight for either side, either the government or the guerrillas or the paramilitaries. This community, it's in the northern part of Colombia, in an area called Urabá, which is historically FARC territory. That's the guerrillas. And the FARC, the state has almost never had a presence up in that area until about maybe in the last couple of decades. And so the guerrillas had a strong presence. They were sort of the law and order. Anybody was caught beating their wives, they would have to respond to the FARC. So, you know, they sort of infiltrated all aspects of life as well as being sort of the military force in the area.
Right.
And so this community, because they were in FARC territory and also because the U.S., or I'm sorry, the Colombian government would come after the FARC, they would sort of get caught in the middle. And so they, like a lot of the other folks that started peace communities, decided that they had had enough and they wanted to declare themselves neutral, which, because Colombia is been suffering from a civil war for about 50 years, it's a pretty radical thing.
Right. And when exactly did they do this?
They declared themselves as a peace community in 1997.
Okay.
And that was a time in which there was a lot of paramilitary presence that was pushing into Antioquia, which is the area where they live. And so they were seeing at that point a lot of persecution and massacres, killings, people being forced off their land. And so basically as a way to try to stay on their land, they declared themselves a peace community and said, we're not working with either side and we're going to stay and hold our ground.
Okay. Now, are there others like the peace community San Jose de Aportado? Was it one of the first communities?
It was one of the first communities.
And was it the success of that community that spurred other rural villages to do the same?
Yeah, I think it was a success, but more it was just a radical idea that was being pushed by a bunch of NGOs, including with a lot of participation from the Catholic Church in Colombia, that they were saying that this was the alternative because really they didn't have any other alternative other than leaving their lands or you know, seeing their kids and their family members die.
Right. Now we're gonna try to dissect some of the political implications and the players involved in the civil war and how U.S. might be complicit or involved in this. But what I first want to do is nail down exactly your involvement. You were there. You were a resident for a year. Is that correct?
I was there for about 7 months.
Okay. And what exactly were you doing there? Were you sponsored? Who were you there with?
I was a volunteer, a peace accompanier is what we call it, with an organization called Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a U.S.-based organization, peace and justice organization. They have a team that lives in the peace community of San Jose. There's anywhere between 2 and 4 members of the team that basically just accompany the community. And what that means is we're basically human rights observers.
Right.
And we're non-aligned. I mean, you know, even though we live among the community, we're not members. And
okay.
So we're ideally a neutral entity.
And you were there exactly when?
I was there. I left about this time last year and was there until last fall.
Okay.
So I wasn't there when the massacre happened in February.
Talk to me then, just from your basic experiences, what did you find most inspiring about the peace communities? Was it working? Did you still feel that there was infiltration by different forces? Can you just explain that a bit?
Well, one thing that's really, really stuck out to me was how committed every single member of the community was. I mean, down to even the kids. I remember when I got there was a 16-year-old young man who sat me down sort of the first day I was there and walked through his reasons for being a member of the community, and it had to do with his father being killed and his brother being killed. And he's not alone. I mean, everybody else in the community sort of comes from this history of suffering and watching the people they love suffering.
Right.
And that informing and you know, really forcing them to become a member of the community, because the alternative that they see is people getting killed or leaving. And so I would say the commitment was one of the things that struck out to me most, and the commitment in the face of being targeted for being peace community members. I know you're going to ask me about this, but the massacre that just happened in February,
sure.
That was the leader. There was 8 people that were killed, and 2 of them were leaders. Well, one of them was the founding and sort of principal leader of the community.
And this is Luis Eduardo Guerra?
Yeah, Luis Eduardo Guerra. He was amazing. I had the opportunity to spend some time with him. He actually had been living outside of the community. He's from the area. His wife was from the area and, you know, spent their whole lives there. And then because the community was targeted when it first formed as a peace community, you know, basically because of this idea, if you're not with us, you're against us. So what the FARC says, what the guerrillas say, is that, you know, if you're not going to collaborate with us, that means that you're our enemy, and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, vice versa on the other side. And so he and his family had to leave the area and live in another place in Colombia for about 3 years. And during that whole time, he continued to work for the community and continued to, you know, represent the community in meetings with government officials and with international organizations, and was such an amazing, inspiring leader. And then it was about a year ago, he came back to the community after having not even stepped foot in it for 3 years because he was so threatened.
Mm-hmm.
He'd received so many threats on his life, both for him and his family, that he decided it was best for them to leave. And then they missed home so badly that they came back. And about 3 weeks after that, his wife was killed by a grenade that exploded that was found in one of the fields that had been obviously left by some kind of armed actor. And she and a friend of theirs were both killed. And his 10-year-old son, Daner, was very, very badly hurt. And he was actually one of the people that was killed with Luis Eduardo last month.
On the February 21st massacre.
On February 21st, yeah.
Couple things, and we'll start talking about this event. You were also there just recently, correct? And you went specifically as a response to the massacre, is that correct?
Well, I went back because I had wanted to go back and visit. I mean, it's hard to spend so much time in one place without forming really strong bonds with the people that you're living with.
Right.
So I had wanted to go back and visit, and after what had happened with the massacre, and I could only imagine how disheartened everybody was, because here was this amazing leader that had really helped guide their way for so long, and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the fact that his family and the other family were killed too, I knew that everybody would be in mourning, and I just wanted to, rather than just, you know, send an email or give a phone call, to actually show my support in a little bit more tangible way.
Right.
And also to find out what the massacre was all about, because for me, one of the reasons that I went to be an accompanier was because I felt very strongly about the U.S. involvement in Colombia and how me as a taxpayer, how I'm involved. And so to me, it's very important that we here know what's going on in Colombia and that we report back. And so in order for me to help all the various organizations and individuals that were crafting a response to the massacre in the States, contacting our representatives and also doing other grassroots work. It was important for me to know what had happened, and there's right. this discrepancy about who was the author of the crime, and so I felt like going back I might be able to get some better sense of what had happened.
Okay, so we kind of have to dissect this. One, we have to talk about what was the response in Colombia, and then we have to talk about what exactly has happened or what are the implications with the U.S. government's authorization of continued aid package.
Right.
So one, let's talk about what exactly was the response of the Uribe government, and again, these were eyewitness accounts that alleged these were army officials. So what have they done? Have they launched any investigations? Are they denying complicity?
Well, at first, the government, and specifically the army, denied any complicity in it. They, in fact, denied that they were even in the area at the time, mm-hmm. which that is an undisputed lie. I mean, mm-hmm. that's an undisputed fact that they were in the area, because even the FOR team, the people who replaced me when I left, they said that they knew the army was in town,
right.
or not in town, but in the area. I mean, you can't miss it, because when they're in the area, they're engaged in combat, and you can hear that, and you can see all of the helicopters and everything. And then another thing they said was that they were a 2-day walk away from the area where the massacre happened, which is absolutely impossible, because they have an army base that's about a 5-hour walk from where that is.
Interesting.
Where that happened. So from the beginning, the government, and specifically the army, denied any involvement and said, "Well, it had to have been the FARC." And interestingly, the victims were all killed by machete; they weren't shot. And the FARC, especially in recent years, in fact, there was a massacre that happened close by a few months ago, that the FARC came in and killed some indigenous leaders by machete.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning, the government said, well, they were killed by machete, so it had to have been the FARC, and the government and the army troops were in the area, so we're in no way responsible. But like you said, there were eyewitness accounts that there was an individual, the brother of Luis Eduardo, who was captured when Luis Eduardo and his family were captured, and he escaped. According to his testimony and also several other witnesses, it was the army troops mm-hmm. that had captured them. Whether or not they actually killed them, nobody knows, because all of the people who were there were killed.
Right.
But clearly the army captured them. And whether they turned them over to the paramilitaries, which often is the case, or whether they killed them themselves, nobody knows. And probably nobody will ever know. The government launched an investigation, and from the beginning it was really flawed. I talked to a bunch of the people that were on this commission that went up to exhume the bodies, that went up to where the people were killed and their bodies had been left.
Mm-hmm.
And these are international observers with FOR and several other organizations, including Peace Brigades International. And the stories they tell of how the troops reacted to the scenes, like, for instance, there was a soldier that picked up a bloody machete that was near the victims and took it over to the river and washed it off and put it back. And when people said, no, you can't do that, he said, why not? You know, this is the machete that beheaded all the victims.
Right.
And so, and you know, there were other horrible stories about they were laughing and all the victims came out and everything. So,
let me ask you this then. The immediate response of the government was also that they would no longer respect the peace community's edict, which basically said no guns, no armed forces allowed.
Right.
So have they used this as an opportunity to basically break this barrier of peace?
Yes, absolutely. The government from the beginning has, the Colombian state, has been opposed to the creation of peace communities, because I like to explain it as a civil war is a war over territory, and any territory that the state doesn't control is essentially ceded to their enemies. Mm-hmm. Now, the guerrillas look at it the same way. Anything that they don't control is ceded to their enemies. So the idea of having a neutral space in a war situation is too threatening to either side, especially to the government. And since the start of the peace community, that's been an issue and mm-hmm. has always led to a very contentious relationship between the community and the state. For about the past year, the government was saying, we need to establish a police post in San Jose, in the town center, so that we can have a presence there. And with this police post will come all of the benefits of the government, such as schools and healthcare and transportation and communication and all of the things that the state is required to supply to its citizens by law. And it was after this, after the massacre, that rhetoric got much more heated up. Mm-hmm. And the government, in fact, went as far as creating a police post. Even though they've been talking about this for a year, they didn't actually create it until I was there, which was a couple of weeks ago when the government troops first came in. I'm sorry, the police came in. And so now they have a police post in the town center of San Jose, and the community's response to that was, because they don't want to live among armed actors, they displaced from the community. And so they moved into another part of land, which meant they left their entire lives. They left their houses, they removed themselves from their fields. These are primarily campesinos, so they're all farmers.
Right.
So they work the land, and those who don't work the land have stores, that supply stuff to people who live in the area. And so all of those people had to not only leave their land, but leave their stores, leave their homes, and they started building a new community.
Right. What I want to talk about then next is, because it's impossible to do a discussion on the Colombian Civil War in 30 minutes, but we're trying to cover some of the basics that are most relevant to the unfortunate massacre on February 21st. The response by the United States Congress, I know that when this immediately happened, there were many email notices that went out that said, please contact your representatives because they are considering the reauthorization or recertification of Colombia's human rights record.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened with that? Have they authorized the fundings to be spent regardless of this massacre, or is this still stalled in Congress right now?
Well, according to congressional law, to U.S. law, Colombia has to be certified every year that it's respecting human rights conditions. And
mm-hmm.
in the history of certification, which I think goes back at least 10 years, Colombia has only been denied once, despite the fact that even the State Department's human rights report that comes out every year continues to show evidence that human rights are a serious problem for the Colombian government, that numerous battalions and individual soldiers have been proven to be responsible for massacres and disappearances and tortures and other kinds of human rights abuses. What is going on with that? What happened right after the massacre was there was a flurry of lobbying on the part of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and a lot of other organizations
mm-hmm.
that deal with Colombia issues. And the problem with the certification law is that if Colombia is not certified, which means that if it's found by Congress or by the State Department, it's the Secretary of State that makes that decision.
Mm-hmm.
If Colombia is found to be not compliant with human rights law or with human rights concerns and therefore is not certified, only 25% of the aid that the U.S. gives to Colombia can be either held up or discontinued. So that means that no matter what Colombia's human rights record, 75% of the aid still goes.
Right. And if we're talking about a package that could be $600 million, that's still quite a bit of change.
Exactly. It's still a lot of money. I know that immediately after the massacre, that certification process was put on hold. I have not heard whether it's gone forward or not. It's possible that it has, and it just hasn't reached me yet. But
okay.
Last I knew, it was on hold.
Right. Okay, let's try to now approach this with a greater look to exactly some of the motives and also just the state of civil society in Colombia. I refuse to look at incidences isolated from a larger framework. And so this might be a bit bungled discussion, but I don't like any others. So first of all, in terrorism. We constantly hear that our efforts in Colombia are in an effort to promote anti-narcotics or eradication programs.
Mm-hmm.
And since 2001, that, of course, has been conflated with our war on terrorism.
Right.
Interestingly enough, in 2001, according to the State Department's annual report, Patterns of Global Terrorism, Colombia ranked number one in the world for suffering the most acts of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 186 terrorism incidents occurred, and 82% of those were on oil pipelines managed by U.S. or British companies. So
mm-hmm.
a very interesting and narrowed form of terrorism,
mm-hmm.
one has to point out. But what exactly might be the most, because we're also dealing with the paramilitaries here.
Right.
Now, the peace community, and this is, I did some research and I found that they were actually looking to extend their peace community to neighboring zones.
Right.
And they had planned to do this on March 23rd, which would have been the 8th anniversary
right.
of San Jose de Apartado. Do you think that was the main reason in the violence that we witnessed February 21st?
Well,
that this was kind of like a preemptive move, like don't you dare spread peace to other areas?
Well, that was my initial fear. And in fact, I can't say definitively anyway, although I could say based on my recent trip there, that might be an issue, but the people in San Jose told me, most of them said that it wasn't necessarily related to that expanding of the peace community, that rather it was a continuation of targeting civilians in the midst of war.
Right.
And so while the peace community has certainly been targeted for becoming, you know, a neutral zone, and presumably expanding that zone would threaten a lot of places, I don't think that that's what was behind this massacre. But nobody knows. I mean, I don't think because that's because the people there don't think. But then again, nobody really knows because there hasn't been a good investigation thus far that will really, you know, let people know what was behind this atrocity.
Right. Well, that's two demographics that seem to be targeted in civil society in Colombia. One, peace activist since 1997, since the founding of the community, 146 of its members have been murdered.
Right.
And at the same time, since 1986 in Colombia, and these were facts that I had culled in an essay I wrote in 2002, over 3,800 Colombian unionists have been assassinated, many of them leaders of unions.
Right.
So there seems to be a very concerted campaign to terrorize, and whether that's by the government or the paramilitaries, both trade unions, labor unions, and peace activists.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very clear, and in fact, one thing that the community members always point out is that the war in Colombia is waged upon the civilian population. That for every one combatant killed, one armed actor from any side, six civilians are killed. And so the majority of those civilians are basically caught in the crossfire. And some of them are, yes, political activists, like
right.
trade unionists and peace activists. And yes, they're assassinated as well. They're the area where the peace community is located in Urabá was a very strong part or central area for the Pacific Union, the Unión Pacífica,
mm-hmm.
which was the political wing of the FARC that was created basically in the 80s, and it was created because presumably the civil war is being fought because the social interests that underlie the FARC or the guerrilla mentality, which is that the unequal distribution of land and resources, were never being addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guerrillas started an actual political party, a political wing. And what happened to the UP in the 80s and 90s was that almost every leader or candidate or office holder was assassinated. And so thousands, I think about 3,000, of the party leaders were assassinated. And so it was basically a genocide
right.
of the left, of anybody who wanted to organize in politically in Colombia. So yeah, it's definitely true. That
And what I find most interesting now is that part of the Plan Colombia funds are being considered for a demobilization program,
right,
under which members of the paramilitary groups who agree to give up a life of what they call narco-terrorism could be eligible to receive U.S.-funded job training,
right,
and actually Colombian-paid stipends. So in effect, and I know that this has caused problems because George Bush has signed legislation that anyone who provides material support to terrorist organizations could be prosecuted under the law. Now, the paramilitary groups have been labeled by the State Department for many years terrorist organizations, but yet now we are using funds from Plan Colombia to actually re-enter them into the civil society.
Exactly.
And I know that reports are, you know, a wonderful place to get some great news coverage on Latin American issues, narconews.com,
mm-hmm,
and they have quite a few reports that they're terrified that the paramilitaries have turned into a mafia-like organization in which they've infiltrated political offices, and now they almost have this kind of quiet or tacit connection with the government, but they just don't wear the camouflages and guns so readily.
Right, exactly.
Marcy, this is a total mess. I want to just thank you for trying to shed some light on it, and I also just want to say I admire your work and your commitment towards the issue and themes of peace in Colombia and elsewhere. If somebody was interested in the Fellowship of Reconciliation, is that correct?
Yes.
Where can they find more information on this?
Well, they have a website. The address is www.forusa.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's a link to the Columbia Project.
Okay, super. Marcy, thanks again for coming on and speaking with us here at Civil Discourse, and
thank you so
I look
much.
Forward to speaking with you again.
Yeah, great.
All right, take care, Marcy. Again, that was Marcy Lay, an Ithaca resident who's spent some time in the San Jose de Aportado Peace Community in Colombia, in which there was a massacre February 21st, allegedly committed by the Colombian army. Now, I believe I have, what, 1 minute? 1 or 2 minutes? Yes, I'm just going to try to talk about something very quickly here. This issue in Plan Colombia has turned into an absolute nightmare. The goals to eradicate narcotics trade totally ignore the very basic tenet of capitalism. And you think that neoconservatives who love and obey the grand edicts of free market capitalism would understand that this is an issue of supply and demand. We have spent over $3 billion to combat narcotics trade in Colombia, and as we see from the accounts and hear from Marcy Lay, it has done very little to bring peace and stability to a region. The rural poverty in Colombia is close to 85%. We are talking about people who don't have any access to markets, to commodities, and they are now being caught in the crosshairs between various factions of militant organizations, and I include in that category the Uribe government. You could find some more information, I found, by the Center for International Policy. They have a fantastic section on Colombia. Their mission of the CIP is to promote a U.S. foreign policy based on international cooperation, demilitarization, and respect for basic human rights. Their web address is www.ciponline.org. One more issue to close here. We've seen that the chaos in Colombia is now being basically glossed over, and we hear quite contrary how Venezuela has turned into this draconian authoritarian place, when in fact that is not the case at all. One thing that you have not heard is the issue that has just erupted in Mexico this last week, in which the populist mayor of Mexico City, who is ahead by 15% in the presidential polls for 2006, has been stripped of legal immunity and is being prosecuted by the Vicente Fox government on trumped-up charges. Now imagine if Hugo Chavez from Venezuela had stripped the legal immunity of his candidate, of his opposing candidate, who was winning by 15%, and then prosecuted and jailed him on trumped-up charges. We would hear fire and brimstone rhetoric from Washington, yet this is happening in Mexico, and we hear nothing of this. Latin America is a forgotten corner, but there have been some wonderful and devastating stories that are coming out of that region. If you want to learn more, keep on point with some of the issues, I strongly encourage you to check out narconews.com. This is Tariq Abdelazim signing off. You can find this, a copy of this show, as well as the others, on my website, www.modocpress.com. This is a good day to fight, people. Cheers.
Hey, Jack.